Support for this episode of Talking Machines comes from Logi Analytics. Planning to update the dashboards and reports in your application? Lots of business intelligence vendors claim their software is best, but they can't all be winners. Logi Analytics is offering 5 reports from analysts like Gartner and Dresner, comparing 26 BI vendors. Get help focusing your evaluation, prioritizing features, and determining what solution fits your tech stack. Visit logianalytics.com/machines to claim your free reports. That's logianalytics.com/machines. You are listening to Talking Machines. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Neil Lawrence.
And Neil, today I want to talk about a little IRL in the real world. I know that you've been thinking about the physical world and causality. Tell me about what's been in your head lately.
Actually, I spent a week where I was getting together a lot with Bernard, so maybe this is affecting my thinking. Bernard Shawcott, who's big on causality, but he's absolutely right. And what was interesting about it is we have slightly, we care passionately about the same thing, but we're coming at it from different angles, which is great. And that's when I see that in the field, I think that that diversity of approach is critical because neither of us knows what the dominant approach will be. It's almost like the mating of the physical world with our machine learning models and the type of questions people often want to answer. And those are in the form of counterfactuals in terms of what if I were to do this. As we saw last episode around the fairness tool, the what if tool from Google AI. Now, those type of questions can't be answered from a purely descriptive approach. This is the sort of classical inability to separate correlation and causality that we can infer causality, but the points from classical statistics are that in order to do so, we have to have interventionist studies and randomization. So that's the sort of classical approach to inferring causality. The challenge with that is that to deploy such randomized studies is sometimes either very expensive or impossible. So if we're trying to sort of consider, say, a personalized medicine treatment on an individual, we can't randomize them. I mean, we can do things like we can say, oh, we'll try interventions that occur across different times, but there's confounders over what else is going on in their lives. So that's one that's sort of absolutely impossible to deal with. And I think a really important question is when we're doing automated decision making is how, and I mean, I think I'm very curious about how humans do this sort of thing. And that's why I love the fact that we have sort of cognitive science integrating with us as well. But from a pragmatic issue, if I know various things about the real world, how do I make decisions given that I'm sometimes moving into regimes where I know I have no data? So I'm changing something about my physical system, sort of trying to think of good examples. Certainly one example that I have worked on in the past is advice on sort of Formula One strategy, which is very much driven by simulation. So engineers encode their understanding of the race into a simulation, and then they sort of simulate different strategies, like if I'm going to stop my car to change tires on lap 15 and lap 30, what's my expected number of points? And those simulations have assumptions about how other cars will behave and how easy it is to overtake and various things in them. If as the situation evolves, once I've made these changes, this race has never been run before, but I kind of have a sense about how I think these things will evolve. So I want to include that, and I express that in my simulation. That's just quite a difficult task, and it involves a sort of expert introducing their knowledge to the system. Sometimes the simulation can be sort of much more like climate modeling, physical differential equations, which is a deep understanding. But if we don't include that type of understanding in our machine learning models, we're in the same position of never being able to separate correlation from causality. We can't answer the question, what if I change this input to a certain regime where I've never seen before because my model hasn't seen data in that region? Emulation is one approach that I'm very interested in for trying to deal that. So sustaining the simulation and modeling the simulation, machine learning models, but returning to the simulation when you're moving into regimes you haven't seen before. That's one of the reasons I'm very keen on surrogate modeling or emulation, as it's called, this area of uncertainty quantification, because what it says in that domain is if I'm uncertain, I flip back to the more physical realization of the system. So I train my machine learning model on data from that physical realization, but when I'm uncertain, I flip back. There's also, I think, some very elegant descriptions from the sort of probabilistic numerics field that are very closely related around about how much compute do I want to spend on this action? How much do I need this answer to what accuracy? As you start to get in a real physical world, those are the sort of practical questions that you want to address. And also in the cognitive science literature, Thomas Griffith, who we're talking about the other week, is interested in that type of thing. What's the, people talk about rational behavior, but if it's rational under a computational constraint that you need to give the answer quickly, all these are very practical issues that emerge when you have some kind of physical understanding that's slow to compute. And the other area, of course, is what I would think of the statistical study as causality, where you're trying to infer something about these systems by looking at data and applying particular interventions. And, you know, I think, have we mentioned the Book of Why yet? I haven't read it. I've bought it. But Judea Pearl has a sort of more, who's a sort of leader in this field, has written a, I guess, more populist, a more, what I understand is a more lay approach to sort of understanding causality and his approach to causality. I don't know if it's just his approach. Certainly he has an approach called the Do Calculus. There's work of Bernard Chilcott around what a causal system would look like in terms of the noise on the outputs, and I'm sure others. These are really, really interesting areas that I think we need to get to the heart of if we're going to get anything close to the promise of AI as automated decision-making that goes beyond what we're talking about the other week in terms of machine learning systems design, that I'm just going to try and decompose this into a set of subtasks that I have that I'm interested in. Because what this is really saying is, well, we're now using the human to decompose this complex decision-making into something that they reflect. Oh, that I do lane tracking, I do pedestrian detection, whether that's true or not. But if we want real systems, they need to do that kind of decomposition, that sort of analysis themselves, which means that they have to have the ability to characterize that. So the approach that I spoke about in terms of let's have a simulation, let's replace it with an emulation, is allowing humans to still introduce knowledge through the simulation. But then some of these causal studies, these causal ideas are really, in the long term, I hope, going to address the question of what should that mechanistic model look like? Because that's one of the coolest things about human thinking, is that you can get a Formula One race engineer to decompose a race into these things that they see as important, right? But how is it that they know that those are the important things? Or how do we even validate how they've abstracted the race? I don't know. That's a really, really tough problem. We can sort of validate against real world data, but if we have a specific change that someone's proposing, can we say it's the right change or not? These are super difficult problems that I think we're some way from resolving, even despite all the exciting advances we have.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll have a link to the Book of Why and also to some of Bernhard Chilcott's papers on this topic on our website, thetalkingmachines.com. So this week's question on Talking Machine is about an article about a paper, which might be a little hard to unpack, but let's try to work through it, Neil. So our listener writes, I recently read an article from Quantum Magazine about a paper from Richard Zemmel and a couple of other researchers. The article was about a computer vision paper that had, the system had been trained on images of living rooms, but then seemed to be very confused when an image of an elephant was introduced. The writer of this article seemed very surprised by this, but me, having some small background in machine learning, feels like this would be the outcome that you would expect. How do we bridge that gap in the public conversation around these ideas? And also, should I be surprised that a model trained on a living room can't recognize an elephant? So, Neil, should we be surprised by the elephant in the room? I mean, also, to me, that seems like the thing that you would expect. If you've trained a model on chairs and TVs and video game systems, then it's not going to know what an elephant is. Maybe an elephant is a huge couch or something like that.
It's interesting. I mean, I wonder if the question is more about what the public perception of machine learning is versus the actual capabilities. I mean, so my example of this is a sort of when we were did Data Science Africa in Nyeri this year, we had a team from Arm, Damon Chivin and Jan Longboon out there with Shiromania teaching the students how to deploy sort of photo traps in the conservancy of the university where there's sort of various animals.
And a photo trap is when you take a camera that's sort of automated and the camera knows when there are animals in the area, or it senses movement, it turns on, it takes a bunch of photos, and then it turns off when there's nothing there anymore. Is that right?
That's right. That's exactly right. So the aim of the workshop, which I think is a super important aim, was end-to-end learning. What I mean like that is not necessarily, or the end-to-end data science process, I should say. Not just putting a large neural network and having to do everything, which is an interesting approach people are doing in end-to-end, but going from the field to answering the question, say, at the Ministry of Agriculture or the Ministry of the Environment, and back into the field. So being able to, certainly, I find that fascinating because it sort of causes you to think about the entire data science pipeline. In that environment, in the African environment, it's very often the case that there isn't existing infrastructure for doing part or more of that job. So, you know, often the researcher, the data scientist needs to be equipped to do the whole thing. And anyway, the point of that story was that the, I think that they used, Damon got ImageNet running on, I can't remember the processor that they were using. And it just thought everything was a llama.
Oh no, like everything?
I think it thought everything was a llama. I may be confused because there's also actually, oddly, there is a llama in the conservancy. But I think, it's kind of whatever it thought, it had this same problem because it's not a general machine learning system. It's just trained on what it's trained on. And I don't know the details of the paper, but if the gist of the article, as it seems to be, is, isn't it surprising that it doesn't recognize the elephant? I think there's some contextual stuff going on as well. So I think one of the senses is that the elephant changed the nature of the objects around it. And without knowing the details of the algorithm, it kind of makes sense that there's... So we talked about decomposition the other week into... Well, I mean, it relates to a few of the things we've spoken about. But if we're providing data sets where elephants are not seen typically in houses alongside chairs... You know, humans are very good at using context to understand something specific. And what I think that this is indicating is that the neural network is picking up on context, not as cleanly as it might do, which is not really surprising. I think I would agree. Well, to be careful, because I haven't looked at the nuances of the paper, that headline conclusion isn't that surprising to a machine learning researcher, but it's probably very surprising to many members of the public. I thought you made a nice point about the What If tool the other week, about it being a great tool for members of the public to understand some of the issues around data. And maybe this article is really just reminding us of that things that are perhaps maybe less surprising to researchers, very surprising to the general public, because the general public has this perception that we're somehow recreating human intelligence, which is not what we're doing. I mean, we're emulating it in some way, but it's kind of distinct in various ways.
They have a few quotes in the article from the author team, and one of them seems to be just sort of like very much along these lines. Amir Rosenfeld, who's at York University and is one of the authors on the paper, says, literally, "There are all sorts of weird things happening that show how brittle current object detection systems are." I mean, that seems like the headline. Like,
yeah, although I think he's right, but I worry that these type of messages turn into other headlines I've seen that sort of says machine learning is magical and no one understands. The frightening thing about our machine learning algorithms is no one understands why these things work, which is also not true. It's like, we kind of understand why it's difficult to understand. These are high dimensional spaces. I have my pinball analogy that I sometimes use to try and communicate that in these models, it's like a pinball machine in massively high dimensions, and there's just pins in places in the machines where the ball's never gone before. And when it goes there, unpredictable things happen. And, you know, that's exactly what happened to AlphaGo. Lee Sedol played it into that spot. And when that happens, well, AlphaGo's kind of all out of luck. That's something I think we're very aware of, and people would like to address, and certainly I think about ways of addressing that. People propose Bayesian neural networks as one way of addressing that. So I think it's true. So it's difficult, isn't it? This is the challenge, is getting nuanced. So I wouldn't disagree with what Amir is saying, but just caution against the sort of other, like, as soon as the word, you know, there's weird things happening in neural networks, like as if the fabric of mathematics has broken down, is the worry that I have that's interpreted. But I can also agree with the sort of sense of it. But getting nuanced views across to the general public is very, very hard. And also the nuanced view isn't necessarily the best view for an article writer to pick up if they're interested in getting attention on their article, which most journalists are. So there'll be a pre-selection of a particular type of article, which is inevitable. We can't avoid it. Yeah, so I think, you know, it's probably a really interesting article. I haven't read the details of the article that Amir, John and Rich wrote. They're great people, so I'd have no reason to think it's not. But it's almost inevitable if you talk about the elephant in the room, someone's going to want to write an article. I suspect they may have known that themselves. So there may be some guilt with the researcher if there is a misleading, but they who's above that to a certain extent? Well, we have to watch that type of stuff.
No, absolutely. And this is also an interesting trend, right? As you try to make pure research more accessible, you use words that are perhaps more exciting in your title. You maybe make the title of the paper shorter. You make it sort of more open for lay entry into the conversation, which can be great and is sometimes a new territory. So it's like sometimes very difficult to navigate deftly. But the thing that makes me really excited about this is that this is a popular article in the popular press written about an academic paper. And he actually talks to the researchers and they're quoted. And there's a nice little infographic about deep learning and explaining what a layer is. This is the first step into actually having a conversation. Yeah, totally.
No, that's nice. I like that. But just by the same token, I think one could also take Amir's quote and reapply it to the process of getting there's all sorts of weird things that happen in the journalistic pipeline that show how brittle our understanding of academia is. I mean,
yeah, exactly. You can apply that to literally any part of this whole flow, right?
Yeah, and there's some sort of hope in the end that despite all these weird things, that there's some sort of average answer that will reflect what actually goes on. And I think, yeah, you're right. I think this is a nice article. Is it surprising that that's the surprising thing? Maybe it's not even surprising at some meta level, but also it's a reminder that our understanding as experts differs from the understanding of the general public.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if you've got a question for Talking Machines, or you've got an article that you were surprised by, or an article that you weren't surprised by, email us at thetalkingmachines@gmail.com or tweet at us at TLKNGMCHNS.
Support for this episode of Talking Machines comes from the National Security Agency. Almost every day we hear something on the news about cyber attacks. Sometimes it's just a bunch of pranksters, but more often it's a foreign country with vast cyber resources trying to hack our power grid, our banking systems, or military's information networks. The National Security Agency plays a big part in protecting our country from cyber attacks, and you can help. The NSA is hiring technical professionals to serve on the front lines of information security. If you work in computer science, networking, programming, or electrical engineering, you can help keep the country safe. Design new hardware systems and networks, write faster, smarter programs, protect America's critical infrastructure, or help uncover what our adversaries are planning to do next. Learn more about careers at the National Security Agency today. Visit intelligencecareers.gov/NSA. That's intelligencecareers.gov/NSA. This week's guest on Talking Machines is Kush Varshney of IBM Research. And when we got a chance to sit down and talk with him at ICML in 2018, I asked him the first question we ask all of our guests. How did you get where you are?
Yeah, it's a long story. I've been at IBM now about 8 years. I guess in college, I was a major in electrical and computer engineering and just felt that it was, a good field to be in. It was kind of doing new things, trying to, use technology for good stuff. And then within that, I was more attracted to the more mathematical side of things, kind of signal processing, communications, these sort of things. And when I was applying for grad school after that, I ended up at MIT and I was working with Professor Alan Wilsky. And in his group, we were, doing a lot of different things. So I initially started doing some radar image formation sort of work, doing some sparsity things before compressed sensing was even a term. And kind of that led to, some more work in this general direction. And then for my PhD thesis, I was doing some kind of taking a new approach for classification algorithms with a geometric regularization term that was inspired by some techniques from image processing. And yeah, all of that was kind of, work that was, leading me more towards machine learning. And then as I was looking for jobs, IBM Research was one that I had applied to, and it felt like a great fit for me. This was kind of before the whole tech bubble or AI bubble or whatever you want to call it. So IBM Research was, I joined the math department, which had a long history of over 50 years doing a lot of fundamental work in optimization theory and other stuff. And I joined a group led by Sashka Mojsilovic, and it was doing, the group was doing a lot of work on what was called analytics at that time, business analytics and so forth, and doing a mix of kind of more fundamental machine learning research, as well as applying things to fields which at that point you wouldn't think were actually being looked at through the lens of data and machine learning and so forth. So we started doing work on human capital management and workforce analytics. We were doing work on healthcare sort of problems as well. Yeah, it was a great fit for me to get going. And just being a researcher in an industrial research lab has been a great experience so far.
That's fantastic. Awesome. And you're part of the data analytics research group right now, right?
Yeah. So actually, since last September, we've created within IBM Research this overall IBM Research AI organization. And within that, there's an AI science part, which includes machine learning and machine reasoning and so forth. So I am in the learning part of it. And yeah, our mission right now is to do as much kind of fundamental research as we can to push the boundaries of the technical approaches that are relevant for IBM's customers and more broadly in the scholarly sense as well.
Nice. Excellent. And you're also part of the group at IBM that's focused on science for social good. Tell me about that.
That's one of the things that I really look forward to doing when I wake up. So Sashka, who I mentioned before, and I, a few years ago, we launched this new initiative, which we call the Science for Social Good Initiative. Done about 20 or 25 projects so far, in which we collaborate with different nonprofit or social entrepreneurship sort of organizations. So that could be people looking at poverty or hunger or equality of various sorts. And we try to identify some problem with them in common where we can bring some value, and they have the solid subject matter expertise. And we try to do a short project. We don't, imagine that we can really solve poverty in a summer internship sort of project or anything. We have done, some good illustrative projects with various organizations that actually show that some of the techniques that we bring can be valuable in pushing the social sector forward.
That's fantastic. Tell me about one of them that really excited you or had a really unexpected or interesting outcome.
Yeah, one of the projects we've been doing, or we started, a couple of years ago, was in partnership with the Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies, so the project was around zoonotic diseases. These are diseases that transfer from animals into humans. Mm. Many diseases are of that type, and they're a growing concern because humans are now encroaching onto the wild much more than they had been before. And
are we talking about domesticated animals or food animals?
Yeah, so wild animals like primates, so monkeys in the wild and so forth. So Zika virus is an example of one that was in the news a few years ago because it had transferred into the Americas, whereas it had only been in Africa for the previous 50 years. Mm-hmm. It was causing microcephaly, which is small heads and other developmental issues in newborns for infected pregnant mothers. Mm-hmm. And so what we were trying to do in the project at that time was to identify or predict the reservoir species for the virus. And a reservoir species is an animal that gets infected but doesn't have symptoms and doesn't die. So they're not the vector, actually. So a vector would be a mosquito. So a mosquito would go bite the reservoir species, get the infection, and then bite a human, and then the human would get it. And in the wild, these reservoir species keep the virus alive so that it, just persists and so forth. And in Africa, there were a couple of known reservoirs, but in the Americas, it was not known what those would be. And the features that our collaborators at the CARE Institute had identified were a lot of behavioral and physiological characteristics of primate species that help us predict whether a particular species can be a reservoir or not. So we built a model based on those features predicted for the Americas, and we were able to identify among the about 200 or so species of primates in the Americas which ones are most